Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Up next, JPR's Charlie Zimmerman offers a collection of short news features from around our region.
I'm Charlie Zimmerman. A clarinet professor from the University of Oregon has been chosen as the artistic director for Clarinet Fest. It's the world's largest gathering of clarinet artists, performers, and educators. KLCC's Sagina Strescia spoke with him about how his work at the U of O in teaching philosophy will inform the next Clarinet Fest.
The piece you are hearing is called Scenery for Sky. There are three instruments present in this piece, two gayagams, a Korean traditional musical instrument, and a clarinet, which is played by UO professor Wonkok Kim. This type of intercultural collaboration between Korean traditional music, Korean composers, and the clarinet is something Kim has been doing ever since he arrived at UO. He told me this collaboration informs his teaching.
I've been sort of developing, you know, teaching philosophy that really broadens the students' creative output and creative potential by tapping into something a little bit more than what conventionally we were, told to do. And for me personally, it's been always sort of exploring my own heritage as a Korean-American person. And it's not obviously limited to that, but I found very practical and beneficial way to sort of work in this sort of intercultural collaboration, through intercultural collaboration. So that work itself, I think, generated a lot of interest in, among my students. So that nothing more gratifying for me to see than, say, a piece that's been born through collaboration with the Korean composers. And all of a sudden, this local students from Oregon, they find the work fascinating, they want to learn and perform. And the composers, when they hear the students in Oregon, for example, to perform this music by the person in Korea, I mean, it's just incredible.
This collaborative work can be heard at this piece, titled Blush for Solo Clarinet. Kim performed this piece at the Schnitzer Museum of Art in 2019. The piece was composed by Korean composer Jin An. An arranged the notes and tempo in the style of traditional Korean music, and here, Kim brought it to life with a clarinet. Now, as artistic director for Clarinet Fest, he hopes to bring this form of collaboration through music to an international stage.
Yeah, I mean, as everybody knows, music has such an incredible power to bring people together, probably because, you know, sometimes you don't really need to use the word or politics or ideology. I mean, you collaborate through intuition and the sound, and there's something really wonderful about it, something so human or something beyond human. So like I said, clarinet certainly is, it's kind of odd instruments, you know, it by itself, it's just a little black wooden stick, you know, it doesn't mean much. But when it enables people from such diverse background, and for the upcoming Clarinet Fest, I mentioned it will be, you know, 2,000-3,000 people from all over the world. As we know, there's so much division and conflicts everywhere, like, you know, like Olympics or anything else. I think these world events can bring people together and remind us how important it is to be connected.
This idea of connection is also what guides Kim on the theme of the next Clarinet Fest.
This year's theme, I think, is tied to sort of highlighting the regional artists and establishing the new sort of tradition. So it's a little bit more complex. I can't think of my on top of my head because it's very ambitious. For example, the people who collaborate with traditional musicians of Korea or from Taiwan or Japan, or exploring works by composers from the region. I think those are definitely the work that we'd like to feature. And I think it's beneficial for everybody. You know, for the regional artists, it's a world stage where they can showcase their work. And for the attendees from non-Asian countries, it's a wonderful opportunity to observe that firsthand and also be acquainted with this wonderful musicians and learn about this new possibility.
Kim is excited to be a representative of this form of collaboration. He says that his experiences as a Korean-American clarinetist prepare him for this big stage.
You know, I'm here in Oregon as a clarinet professor, but in a way that I do represent the American sort of traditional clarinet school, and also a person who has a deep connection and understanding of Korea and the regional culture. So I think that's sort of the ultimate sort of vision for this upcoming Clarinet Fest, and I'm looking forward to see how it comes to fruition.
The upcoming Clarinet Fest will be held in Incheon, South Korea in July. I'm Sagina Shrestha reporting.
The first feature film ever made in Idaho was shot more than a century ago. It included more than 100 members of the Nez Perce tribe. Although only a third of the film has been able to be recovered, it's been digitized and edited into a short film. Northwest Public Broadcasting's Lauren Patterson has more.
It's dark and cool in the Kenworthy Theater, despite the sun shining outside. Colin Mannix, the theater's executive director, is prepping to watch a rough cut of the new version of a Western romance lost to time.
It was made in 1919, and it was an unusual film, even for early cinematic standards, because of the unique and unprecedented collaboration with the Nez Perce tribe.
Told in the Hills is considered the first feature film shot in Idaho. It was filmed in Kamiai on the Nez Perce Indian Reservation. Black and white footage of mountains fill the screen. The silent film's story follows Jack Stewart, played by Robert Warwick, a man from a wealthy family who tries to escape some family drama by heading west. But he gets himself into trouble. More than 100 members of the Nez Perce tribe were invited to participate in the filming.
They presented a lot of authentic cultural regalia as a part of the production.
The film went missing over the decades, but at an event last year, Mannix got a tip about a Boise State University professor who had researched early Idaho films.
There's a BSU English professor, Tom Trusky, in the 80s, who did the original kind of deep dive and scan for early Idaho film materials, and he was able to identify that this partial print existed in a Soviet archive.
Films like Told in the Hills were printed on actual film back then. They were mailed in big tins around the world for showings in different theaters, and they would get played over and over again.
They'd experience some wear and tear.
That's Gwen Hervishon, an archivist with Boise State University.
As I understand it, the Soviet Union was one of the last stops.
She says some of those films ended up staying in the Soviet Union and getting locked away. Trusky wrote to the Russians about the film during the Cold War, and the Russians wrote back.
We have two reels that have survived of Told in the Hills.
The 35mm print was sent back to BSU in 1987. This past spring, Mannix went down to Boise and was able to find it in the university archives with some help from Hervishon. The team had the film digitized, and then Mannix looped in his friend Tom Frank, a producer living in LA, to edit the film. Only a third of the film was found, so Frank had to work on how to build a narrative from the reconstructed video and photo stills.
The way that it relies on the inner titles and the music to do so much more of the lifting than what we're used to by today's standards of storytelling had a lot of really kind of fun challenges.
Frank says as he's going through the process, he's combining newer footage and using a special filter to match the black and white images. Like many silent films, there will be music throughout the whole picture. The score for the silent film was created by Diné composer Connor Chi. Because Frank is still working on the film, Chi says it was a challenge to create a soundtrack.
What I ended up doing was writing, I think it's about 17 different pieces, 17 cues that had, a variety of emotions that could match what I'd seen on the screen in this rough cut.
The music score will be performed live at the movie showing. Being a member of the Navajo Nation, Chi says he doesn't have to explicitly try to give his work an indigenous feel, because it's always woven into his work. But he says he did approach the music with a historical lens.
I wanted the melodrama and to match sort of the time period in that sense of what you're seeing on screen.
The new version of the restored film will premiere at the Kenworthy Theater in downtown Moscow on the last Friday and Saturday of September as part of the theater's Silent Film Festival. Reporting in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lauren Patterson.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Charlie Zimmerman, here with a selection of features from around our region. In Eugene, a traditional Mexican folk dance is helping many Latina kids to connect with their culture. For Hispanic Heritage Month, KLCC Sagina Stresta followed a local ballet folklorico group to learn more.
I'm in a church in West Eugene where Ballet Folklorico Colibri is practicing. The dance group mostly consists of Hispanic preteens and teens. Its members are taking turns and dancing in lines of three. Their dance shoes tap against the wooden floor of the dance studio. The dance they're practicing is Ballet Folklorico, a form of traditional Mexican folk dancing that combines local folk culture with standard ballet practices. Mari Sojo founded Ballet Folklorico Colibri in 2017. She says it started as a way for her to share her culture with her daughters.
I have two girls, very young at that time, and I noticed that there was not place for them to dance. They both are dancers, but from the classic ballet, modern, contemporary, tap, jazz, all other disciplines, but not folklorico. So I think it was one of the big things that helped me or pushed me to start, because our community needs a space for representation.
In 2022, Sojo's daughter, Dania Covarrubias Sojo, became a dance instructor for Ballet Folklorico Colibri. She echoes her mother's sentiment about providing a space for Latina kids to be themselves and connect with their culture.
I know that it's really valuable to me because I didn't grow up with a space like this, which is very common in Eugene. There's not a lot. And me growing up in a small town next to Eugene, it was even harder. So this is like a very special, near and dear thing to my heart because it's what I wish I had. And I didn't, so why not create it, you know?
You gotta turn on both sides. Okay. It can be as slow as you need it to be. That's fine.
Back at the class, Covarrubias Sojo instructs the students after observing their dance practices. The students listen to her as she commands the classroom, eager to learn and improve. Henry Hernandez Moreno, an 18-year-old student who started with Folklorico a year ago, says he really likes being part of the Folklorico dance group.
I've seen a few Folklorico dancers online, and I was once thinking, I was like, maybe I could do this one day, and now I'm here doing it, and it's really fun.
Another student, Kayla Jean, says Folklorico has helped her grow out of her shell.
When I performed, especially when I started, I didn't smile at all. I was just stone cold faced, and I was shy. I was like very kept to myself, teacher's pet kind of child. Now I'm very open. I can be quite loud in my presence, but I take my part and I make sure like the newcomers, they feel welcomed as well, and so they can stay.
Jean adds that sometimes her identity as an Afro-Latina can make her feel like a minority within a minority. But she says the friends she has made from Folklorico have helped her feel welcome.
I like the community. There's kind of like the sense of you belong here. It's really nice, and you get to know everybody, and it's like this giant family.
Ballet Folklorico Colibri performs at venues throughout Oregon. I'm Sagina Shrestha reporting.
Pacific Northwest drivers are paying some of the highest gasoline prices in the country at the moment. But as Kyra Buckley reports, relief may not be far away.
A major pipeline outage plus maintenance at the region's refineries spiked gas prices in Oregon and Washington recently. Those things happened to coincide with the last 2 weeks before gas stations switched from summer to winter fuel blends, according to AAA. Winter fuel blends are cheaper to produce, but experts say it could take 3 to 6 weeks for that to show up at the pump. Oregon drivers also currently pay a state gas tax of 40 cents per gallon, the 12th highest in the country. Washington's taxes are even higher, the 4th highest in the nation. That's on top of a federal gas tax of 18 cents per gallon. I'm Kyra Buckley reporting.
Oregon's Employment Relations Board reprimanded the University of Oregon this month over the school's past treatment of its student workers union. The board ruled that U of O acted unlawfully when it asked employees to remove union pins and not to discuss labor organizing on the clock. U of O also reportedly blocked signature gathering in residence halls, stopped a union organizer from presenting in class, and told residents' assistants that they could lose out on a raise based on the outcome of the union's campaign. U of O Student Workers Interim President Mae Braceland says these incidents were early in the union's formation.
Most of these issues have since that time ceased as the university has like pulled itself together on understanding that U of O student workers are local, is a union, isn't going anywhere, can't be pushed around.
The board did not issue any fines against the university. U of O did not immediately respond to a request for comment from KLCC.
And that's it for today's JX. Thanks for joining us and have a nice day.